This is WPFW Washington, and today all day we'll be lifting up the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., looking at the Radical King throughout these discussions today, putting him in the context of the discussions you'll hear today. So next up is Verna Avery Brown with What's at Stake. Stay tuned.
There is a rift among those battling the wildfires in LA are incarcerated firefighters, and they're putting their lives on the line for a shocking amount of pay. Is it possible Mother Nature is not the only cause of the wildfires? One lawyer points the finger at fossil fuel companies, and he and others are preparing a lawsuit to sue. Good morning, good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. There's a red flag warning in place for parts of Los Angeles, and the National Weather Service forecasts wind gusts of up to 70 miles per hour between 4 a.m. and noon today, which could lead to explosive fire growth. The Palisades Fire has engulfed 23,713 acres and is the most destructive fire in LA's history. The Eaton Fire erupted in Altadena shortly after the Palisades Fire and has burned 14,117 acres. The Hearst Fire erupted the same day as the Palisades and Eaton Fires and covers 799 acres. But as of Monday, it's been almost fully contained. The Palisades Fire is 14% contained as of Monday afternoon, and the Eaton Fire is 33% contained. 8 people died as a result of the Palisades Fire, and 16 people died in the Eaton Fire, the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner said in a news release. Mexico and Canada are sending firefighters and equipment to help battle the blazes scorching Southern California, an expression of solidarity, their leader said, and recognition of the assistance the United States extends to its neighbors in times of need. Teams of firefighters from states across the U.S., including Texas, Arizona, Utah, Oregon, Colorado, and Nevada. Historically, prison inmates are used to help fight the blaze, and currently, over 900 incarcerated persons are battling the fire in LA. California's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation Secretary Jeff McComber says the incarcerated firefighters are essential to controlling the blaze. They make up roughly 30% of California's team historically. Inmates are paid between $5.80 to $10.24 per day, not per hour, per day. It's incredibly low pay for incredibly high risk, but it's considered the best job for an incarcerated person. Anthony Pedro was an incarcerated firefighter until he was released in 2018. The experience dramatically altered the course of his life. He's now the founder of the Future Fire Academy. And more on this remark, his remarkable journey to developing his own firefighting business. But first, I want to talk more about his experience as an incarcerated firefighter. Good morning, Anthony Pedro. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Verna. Thank you for having me on. Yeah.
Well, we know it's pretty early out there, and so we appreciate you getting up early. So Anthony, tell us why you chose to risk your life battling a wildfire while you were in prison and doing so for only $5 or $10 a day.
Yeah, well, my sentence that I had was 13 years at 85%. And so of that, that's with the good behavior, I was able to get out in 9 years because I got my associate degree in fire science and earned a couple certifications to help me do the fire program. So, you know, in prison, there's not a lot of options of things to get get you to the point where you're doing things that's close to normal, normalcy, like the real life, right? Like everything's behind the walls as far as like employment options go. And so like for the FIRE program, it's a career path potential. It's you're able to work, you're able to be out in the free world. So it's like it's the best option for us to, while we're in prison if you do qualify. Yeah, so for me, like I always made it my goal. I started in the higher levels because in California our prison goes the levels level 4, 3, 2, 1, 4 being, you know, where there's lifers that will possibly not come home, or and then or people who have a extreme amount of time, and then or if it depends, it's built on a point system. So the younger you are, the higher the points you have and things like that. So I started off on the high level 4 and worked my way down to 3, 2, 1 with good behavior, and then I was able to enter in the program and finish. I did 3 years in the inmate fire program. So it was always my goal once I started my term. And so but that's why I chose it, was because it's the best thing, best opportunity.
So now you said as long as you qualify. So what is the criteria to be a fire an incarcerated firefighter?
So they go based off of your crime also. So it can't be no sex crime, no arson crime, no abuse of like elder abuse or child abuse, like those things that are pretty much the same qualifications that a fire department, like the Forest Service or Cal Fire would require. They pretty much it, so that's one thing. And then you gotta have a 4 years and under to join. So you can't go in with too much time because then you're a risk, a flight risk. And then also depending on if it's a violent crime or not, certain violent crimes aren't allowed to go in to and then also there's no discipline write-ups that you've been in trouble while you're during your term. And then they also evaluate, it's like a board meeting before you go, and then they'll decide if you qualify or not, like what have you done during your term. Like for me, I was able to show like I have a degree. Like that's how serious I am. I'm about going in this program. So there's definitely a vetting process. And then once you go in, then they do a mini academy that lasts like about 2 weeks. And so it's a week of extensive physical training, and then and then 3 weeks. So then and then another 2 weeks of like academic, you know, curriculum. And
So basically, you're saying, Anthony, that your incentive was the fact that you would get out of prison early, if you did this program. If you put your life, did you consider the fact that, it was a dangerous situation, and you might actually get hurt, and you might actually die? Have any firefighters, incarcerated firefighters, actually died as a result of their service there?
well, you know, while I was inside and as an inmate firefighter, and as a in the firefighter in the free world professionally, that there's always those like close calls that you know, there's certain times that you run into situations where you got to just rely back on your training. You got to rely on your training, go back to your training to be able to get out of that situation, or lean on your leadership if you're not
Did
leading.
you experience any close calls while you were serving?
No, there was it could have been, but I feel like the leadership, they're trained and they're all been professionals for years, so they know how to lead crew members to be able to like keep them out of those situations.
You're saying you didn't personally experience any close calls?
No, not myself.
Okay, so now, what kind of training? Well, first, what kind of equipment did you all was provided for the incarcerated? Were you given firefighter equipment and gear to protect you from the smoke and the flames, just as the other firefighters were given?
Yeah, we get everything that's NFPA rated, and that everything that's rated for like professionals. It can't be expired equipment. It can't, you know, it's got to, if there's any little nick or cut on it, you got to replace it with a new one. Like everything has to be like top, you know, because it's ran, it is a fire department. So like the inmate hand crews, it's ran by Cal Fire. So everything that how they treat their civilian firefighters and everything that they provide them with, they provide with the inmates too, because they're like, it's essential. They are the department. Like how you mentioned earlier, they make up 30%. Mm-hmm. So they are a big factor in the service.
I read one report where a woman incarcerated firefighter was saying they got the hand-me-down equipment.
It never will be like the, so it depends on the department or your unit where you're at, but it might not be the flashiest, newest stuff, but it definitely will still be rated, and it won't be expired, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So professional firefighters, Anthony, undergo extensive training. What kind of training did the prison give you to prepare you to face the blazing infernos and the smoke?
So for my experience, it was the 2 weeks physical training aspect, hiking, running, you know, exercise. Once you pass that, then you do the 2 weeks of more like firefighter training, and that's some more hiking, but now you're hiking mountains because now you got a gate pass to leave the prison, right? And then you can hike up mountains and then do some academic stuff. And so then once I passed those things and I graduated, I went to my my firehouse, where I was at, was as an inmate firehouse, where we're an all-risk department, where we're fighting structure fires, vehicle fires, traffic collisions, vegetation fires like the one in LA, and medical aids throughout the communities. So then I was involved in even more training that lasted over like, was about 6 months of training. And it's kind of like you're approved to go fight fire, but during those 6 months, the more you train, the more you're able to engage.
What kind of jobs were you given while you were fighting the fire? Were you doing the same thing that the professional firefighters were doing, or were you given different types of jobs?
Yeah, so, well, when I started, I was in a backseat rider in the back, you know, kind of like the hoseman who pulls the hose.
Mm-hmm.
Or the hydrant man who, like, when you pull up to the hydrant, you're in charge of getting water to the engine. Then over the time, I worked myself up to being a nozzle man, where now I'm the one spraying the water. And then after nozzle man, then I was able to work up to engineer eventually, where like I was the one that was pumping the engine, sending water to the firefighters, because now I know what it's like to be on the other side of the nozzle and what's expected. And then same thing with the hand tool orders. There's different tools, and the you start off with the ones that do more like scraping, and then you work towards ones that do cutting, and then eventually you'll get on the chainsaw, but you kind of work your way up to the chainsaw. That way you're able to kind of see it more, be around it more, and then you assist the person who runs the chainsaw, and then eventually you're the one using the chainsaw. So over time, you kind of graduate and you build up your skills and lead up to the more the responsibility. So by the time I left, I was an engineer. That's so pretty much with that position, you're a leader over your peers, and you report directly to the captain, who's a civilian correctional officer / firefighter, you know.
Were you ever, and other incarcerated firefighters, ever actually entering burning buildings, for example, or rescuing people?
Oh yeah. Uh-huh. Oh yeah. Yes.
Do you know all that happened?
Multiple structure fires I've experienced. My first one was a commercial bowling alley fire. I've been in residential fires in people's homes, and vehicle fires. I put a tourniquet on a correctional officer's leg. He got sideswiped on his way to work on his motorcycle. His leg was amputated, and we were the first to show up. Mm-hmm. And I was the one to apply the tourniquet on his amputated leg, mm-hmm. to stop the bleeding. And then we loaded him up and put him in the helicopter, and they flew him to the emergency, you know, room. Mm-hmm. So those are all.
Congratulations. You did quite a bit and you rose right to the top of the ranks. Well, now it seems like you all had quite a bit of freedom. You said there were keys. You could actually leave the prison, I would imagine, at will. And you had access to these dangerous things that could have been considered weapons. Were there guards there with you all while you were doing your firefighting duty?
Well, there's always guards near overseeing you, but this is the part where like the vetting process came in. So they really, that's why they vet so hard. So by the time they get the people who go out there, it's like they have so little time left and they have such a great thing going for them that they would never risk throwing that all away to do more prison time and lose that. You know, so like, you know, so that's the they would be around, like, obviously, because the captains, the leaders were also like, you know, officers. So they're able to like oversee you. But if anything, they just encourage to train you better using the tools. So that way, you know, you can use them safely and confidently before we respond to a call of any nature, and you're able to like perform correctly, you know.
But, so I would imagine the guards had to have equipment as well, firefighter equipment as well.
They're getting their hands dirty too. they're definitely getting part of the team, a big factor, you know, in the whole process.
So now, were you required, Anthony, to sign away your rights for any compensation to your family if, God forbid, you had died fighting the fire?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, I've been out now 5 years, so my memory's a little, but I do know when initially when you go into prison, period, you do sign, you know, and when you're sentenced, you're officially state property, you know, once you're sentenced to prison. So, but yeah, it is voluntary that you to go, and there is some documents that you do fill out, I believe so. You write down your next of kin and things like that, but it is a voluntary program.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. My guest at this time is Anthony Pedro, who is the he was an incarcerated firefighter. Now he is the founder of his own organization. Future, help me with the name there, Anthony.
Yeah, Future Fire Academy, a nonprofit.
Future Fire Academy, nonprofit. So, Anthony, your sentence was reduced by how much? You said you had 13 years, but you only did.
Nine. Yeah. Nine? So, okay. Yeah. What happened was, I was a violent crime because I robbed an armored truck. I made a stupid mistake of when I was a young youth, and no, there's no excuses for what I did, but that's what gave me 13 years with 85%. And so what you end up doing 85% of 13 years, it ends up being around like 11 or something. I'm not good at math, but I had it once upon a time. I had it counted down to the days, and I would check off.
So you were there. Were there any killings, any shooting in your crime, the crime that you committed?
No, no killings, no shootings. No one was hurt. But so that's why it didn't end up being violent. So I was still able to enter the fire program.
How old were you at that time?
I just turned 23.
Okay. So listeners, might be wondering, might be thinking $5 to $10 a day. Those are almost slave wages. But we know that the state of California Constitution and the U.S. Constitution allow for involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime. So basically, whether an inmate wants to be a firefighter or not, the state could actually force them to be one, could they not?
Yeah, so they don't, it's all voluntary to join the fire program. They can't make you do it. And then, you know, I know when I was working as an inmate firefighter, I was getting paid $1 an hour. $1 an hour. So I know they've definitely increased it.
That was after, if you'd done an emergency service, that was $1 an hour, and it was up to $24 a day, right?
This is just for the day, yeah, the day work, you know, just working $1, you know, without call incidents or anything. So I know they definitely increased it since my time of being there. But one thing I got to say is that in the fire service in general, across the board, like across the nation, it's you always start off as like volunteer firefighter. So meaning no one really gets paid in the fire service. So like me and my folks, that when we were incarcerated, we just looked at it like as if it was our internship time. You know, we were okay knowing that we're building a career and like getting this opportunity. Like, so for on our side, the increase was nice when we, you know, went for, you know, obviously like income was a great thing, but we do understand that, you know, that the culture of fire service is you have to put in your skin in the game in the beginning of your career path. So it's no, that way, you know, because you think about it, I was able to develop all these skills. And then when I came home, you know, I made history for us Justice Involved folks by getting hired with the municipal department.
Because we're going to get into that a little bit later. But
yeah. Okay. Okay.
I want to talk about this measure that was actually on the ballot in November in California that would have allowed for challenges to the working conditions for incarcerated persons. But that measure actually failed to pass. Are you familiar with that? Are you familiar with that measure?
Yeah. So, I was, and I think by it not passing, I'm trying to. It's just leaving it where folks, you know, when you go in the prison system, there it takes the inmates to be able to facilitate all the moving parts, because it's like a huge company, you know, it's all self-sufficient, you know. So there's different jobs that people make clothes, soap, you know, that we use to wash our bodies, and like there's all these moving parts, and the only way they can really like get done is through the work of the inmates. So like when you get in, they automatically kind of like kind of evaluate you, like what do you want to do, but that you have to like contribute something to it.
I see.
In order.
So,
to-
now, so are inmates clamoring for this job of being a firefighter? I mean, outside of being nature and not stuck in a cell, escaping the violent prison environment and getting your sentence reduced, what other benefits were there to being a firefighter, Anthony?
I think it was a big part of it was being able to be out in the free world, you know, having some sense of normalcy, even though if you're traveling the state, you know, because we'll go all throughout the state traveling, you know, on these fires. We go to all the biggest ones, no small ones, you know, during fire season, but in before and after fire season, we'll go to the smaller, you know, local incidents. But so you're
how did people treat you when they saw you? Was it
yeah, so people hold up signs and you know, they call us the angels in orange, and it's a sense of like redemption, and you feel that pride of like, man, you know, like it's rewarding. And then also you without that aside of getting compliments, because that's not why we do what we do, you know, and we It's the fact that being able to be there at someone's worst day or when their house is burning, to try to salvage and overhaul all their belongings as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Maybe the house was lost, but we were able to bring out as many valuables as we could, rescue the cat and the dogs, you know.
So you fell in love with firefighting, Anthony, and wanted to pursue a career as a professional once you were released, but society was not ready for you. You had quite a little journey. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so I didn't have all the qualifications to get to really excel in the free world, you know, so I had to do a lot of that my own self. And I didn't have a lot of support when I came home. I didn't have a lot of support, so I was actually sleeping out of a car for 6 months. It was a car that was lent to me. So there was a lot of struggles that I had in the beginning, personally, you know, just to like, because when you leave prison, it's like you graduated high school, but now you got a felon on your record. You have no credit, and you're in debt, and no skills. I mean, skills, but no qualifications. So
I see.
So right away, I knew I still wanted to do firefighting. So for my experience, it actually, everything always just really worked out. You know, honestly, I knocked on the door of a department, and it, which is never heard of, which you're not supposed to do, apparently, but they accepted me. Was able to get a sit down interview, and then they told me to apply. And the chief of that department, at one point, he used to be a sheriff, and then he told me that he was a sheriff. And then for me, that was like, oh, great. You know, here's my first door closed. This guy was an officer. But he told me that there's one thing I'm known for that people don't like. And before I was a fire chief, I was a sheriff. But there's one thing that I'm known for, and that's giving people second chances. And I feel like I need to give you one. So he gave me that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I was able to be a volunteer for about 9 months until I got hired on with Cal Fire. So I kind of took a pause from that department and then went with Cal Fire for 2 years and really excelled with them in the free world.
And then you turned around and started your own business. We have about a minute or two left. Tell us about how you did that. Was it government or privately funded? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I'm the founder and CEO of Future Fire Academy. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. And so we're solely dependent on donations to help put folks like myself through the qualifications and certifications to get into the forestry and fire service. So we're accredited through the Western Association of Colleges and Schools. Mm-hmm. And we have great partnerships. We teach in the prisons. We teach in the California State Prisons. And we teach our academy to get them qualified so that way when they leave,
You have firefighters out there in LA now fighting the blaze.
Yeah, we have a lot of alumni have been reaching out to me, and even some folks even reached out to me who are in prison out there fighting those fires. And then they told me that, hey, we're aware of the media and you're getting attention, but we just wanted you to know that there's no one else better. We would like to be the voice of us than you.
Okay.
So the street credit.
Pedro, founder of the Future Firefighter Academy, released in 2018, 67 years later, you have your own business, your passion and persistence paid off. Well done, Anthony. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning.
Of course, Vernon. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Up next, what's the cause of these historic wildfires? LA police arrested one illegal Mexican immigrant with a blowtorch and a yellow fuel tank. Is it arson, Mother Nature? Our next guests say it's the oil industry, and they're planning to sue the fossil fuel companies. Back in a moment.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, January the 13th. To begin, on Tuesday, January 14th from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., the Learn 24 in-person workshop, Intro to Restorative Justice at the Office of the State Superintendent of Education, will happen. More info can be found on www.learn24.dc.gov/. January 18th is action-packed as we honor the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Bright and early on January 18th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., there will be the Student Conservation Association MLK Day of Service at Kenilworth Park, 1550 Anacostia Avenue, Northeast Washington. More info can be found on sca.org. Next, on Saturday, January 18th, from 12 to 2 p.m., it is the annual MLK Day of Service at the UPOPD Green Community Service Center in D.C. More info can be found at mlkdc2025.eventbrite.com. On January 18th at 8 p.m. to 12 a.m., Busboys and Poets presents the 2025 Peace Ball Voices of Justice and Liberation at the Arena Stage at the Mead Center for American Theater in Washington, D.C. More info can be found at www.busboysandpoets.com under the Events tab. Another event on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. will be the Courage and Resilience Justice in Verse Poetry and Storytelling at Wellspring Manor and Spa in Upper Marlboro. More info can be found on Instagram at Wellspring Manor and Spa. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of our event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, while fire is an essential natural process that has shaped the world's landscapes for millions of years, however, extreme wildfires are becoming more frequent, severe, and extensive. When uncontained fire is deadly and has the potential to demolish entire communities at a time. The Los Angeles wildfires, which have reduced entire neighborhoods to smoldering ruins and left an apocalyptic landscape, could become the costliest wildfire in U.S. history in terms of insured losses of analysts' estimates up to $20 billion if they materialize. Dangerously, high winds are expected to resume in Los Angeles, potentially hampering efforts to extinguish two stubborn wildfires that have claimed the lives of at least two dozen people. A warming planet, dry forests, and high winds are generally thought to be the cause of wildfires, yet some scientists acknowledge that human-caused climate change must be factored in. Natural climate solutions that will bring the Earth's ecosystem back into balance will help to address the climate change crisis, including beneficial use of fire and the reduction of the use of fossil fuels, such as coal, petroleum, and gas. Fossil fuel is where we're going to focus this morning on What's at Stake. Jamie Henn is with the Fossil Free Media. Good morning, Jamie Henn, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Vernon.
So, Jamie, how big a role does fossil fuel play in the wildfires that we're witnessing in LA right now? And connect the dots for us between using gasoline in our cars and wildfires burning down homes and communities.
Sure. So, Vernon, scientists are really clear that fossil fuels and the global warming that results from their use is a critical factor in these fires. You can think of it like a baseball player who's juiced up on steroids. You know, not every home run that that player hits is because they're taking steroids, but the steroids make it much more likely that they're going to be hitting things out of the park. And that's what's happening with our climate system right now. We've pumped so much greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that's heated our planet and added energy into the system that results in many of the things that you've talked about. Dried out forests, stronger storms, more extreme weather that fuels these epic wildfires that maybe used to happen once in 100 years or once every decade, now are happening year after year. And so, we look at a disaster like the LA wildfires and can see the fingerprint of big oil and the companies that have been fueling this crisis for decades. And that's why folks like myself and Aaron and a growing coalition of groups across the country are working together with communities to talk about how we can hold the industry responsible for the damage that they've done.
Mm-hmm. So listeners should keep in mind that, when we go get our gas tanks filled up, that's really contributing to this crisis that we're all witnessing in LA. That's what you're saying, isn't it, Jamie?
I think that's right, although it's important to really point the finger at the corporations who are at the root of this. You know, all of us are trapped in an economic system that we live in, and many people don't have the alternatives in front of them to always be able to take public transit or exist without fossil fuels in their daily lives. And a big part of that is because the fossil fuel industry has worked for decades to block those solutions. You know, all the way back in the 1950s, Exxon's own scientists were doing climate research that clearly showed that the ongoing use of their product would result in catastrophic changes. But instead of warning the public, Exxon and other fossil fuel companies went to work to spread disinformation, lied to the public about what was happening. They ran full-page ads in the New York Times questioning the science of global warming. They hired lobbyists in D.C. to block any attempts to deal with the crisis. And they continue to do that today, spending billions of dollars in our elections and pushing back against solutions. So all of us should do what we can to reduce our own emissions, I think it's important to remember that these companies are really at the root of the problem.
Well, so the fossil fuel companies will continue to produce that way as long as there's a demand for it. And how do you suggest we break this cycle of dependency? Do we need to do more recycling? Do we need to buy electric cars? How do we wean ourselves off of that?
Well, I think there's two ways to think about this. You know, first is the incredibly important work of reducing emissions and transitioning to clean energy. And, you know, that work is underway of growing a clean energy economy. We know that every dollar invested in clean energy creates three times as many jobs as a dollar invested in fossil fuels. So this is the future of our economy, and that work is continuing. But there's another important part of this equation, which is actually holding this industry accountable. We know the fossil fuel industry is fighting tooth and nail to prevent clean energy solutions and prevent us from being able to break this addiction to their product. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing is focused on how can we begin to break the stranglehold that these companies have on our economy and our political process. And holding them accountable for these extreme weather events and the damage they've done is one of the important ways that we can begin to get after that problem.
Now, you mentioned Anthony. Anthony Aaron Regenberg, who's also our guest this morning, says that fossil fuel companies have long understood with shocking accuracy that their fossil fuel production would cause, in their own words, globally catastrophic climate change. Instead of changing their business model, alerting the public, or even acquiescing to solutions, fossil fuel companies concealed what they knew and executed a multi-million dollar disinformation campaign to spread doubt about climate science. Good morning, Anthony Regenberg, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Hey, Verna, great to be here.
Thank you for being here. And now, is your position that fossil fuel companies are deliberately causing climate change in exchange for profits? Is that too strong a statement, or what's your position on that?
So, you know, I'm a lawyer. And there's a concept in the law when someone consciously disregards a substantial risk of causing harm to another person. And that concept is recklessness, or criminal recklessness. And that very much seems to be the mode in which big oil companies are operating. As you said, they have known for decades exactly how dangerous their products were. They were predicting decades ago that their fossil products would, quote, do great irreversible harm to our planet, would, quote, have serious consequences for man's comfort and survival, would, quote, create more violent weather, more storms, more droughts, more deluges, would, quote, cause suffering and death due to thermal extremes. Again, these are their words in their internal reports talking about what their products would do. And as Jamie said, I think any of us, any response, you know, or even minimally responsible person, knowing that knowledge, would take action, would at least warn the public about it. Instead, what these companies did was engage in these massive campaigns of fraud and deception to lie to the public about the dangers of their products, specifically in order to block and delay the exact solutions that could have avoided catastrophes like what we're seeing in LA. And by the way, while they were doing that, while they were spreading this misinformation, they were They were so confident in those climate predictions I mentioned that they were using them to make major business decisions, right? Like they were raising the height of offshore drilling platforms to account for the sea level rise they knew was coming, all while telling the public the exact opposite. And when you put all of that together and you look at the climate science as he was describing, you know, we've always had fires. We've always had sparks that start fires. But the science is very clear that climate change is what transformed whatever the sparks that started this fire into the raging conflagrations that we've seen that have destroyed so many homes and ruined so many livelihoods and taken so many lives.
Does this in any way seem analogous to what the tobacco companies were doing prior to decisions that were made where they had to put warnings on the side of the cigarette packages that it could actually cause cancer? I mean, is this similar to that in any way?
It's deeply similar to that. In fact, it's so similar to that. It's the same game plan. Big oil companies use the same, not just the same strategy, the same actual people, the same strategists, the same ad companies to run the exact same playbook that they did around big tobacco, where the big tobacco companies knew for decades that their products were killing thousands or millions of people. And they did everything they could to spread disinformation and stop public health actions that could have prevented those deaths. Mm-hmm. Big oil, when climate change started to become a big topic of conversation in the 80s and ramping up through the 90s, they saw, oh, we've got a problem here. Look what big tobacco did. Let's do the exact same thing. And we do think that some of the legal strategies, some of the legal mechanisms that we're able to at least partially hold big tobacco accountable apply in the same way.
And by the way, what is your lawsuit actually going to charge the fossil fuel companies with?
So there are actually dozens of lawsuits that have been filed by jurisdictions, cities, counties, states around the country that are working to hold big oil accountable. So this is a movement that is already fully enforced. At Public Citizen, we also actually think that there is a criminal component to this, and we have criminal laws to protect us from dangerous actors that would do us harm, things like reckless endangerment, things like in California, for example, it's actually a felony to recklessly cause a fire. And we have these laws to try to keep us safe. And so we think that there's a prosecutor should be thinking about a criminal component of this as well. But the point is we have laws already on the books that we think apply. And as I'm sure Jamie's going to describe, there are additional legal mechanisms that we could be pursuing. And again, it's a pretty simple concept. There are companies that made trillions of dollars creating this crisis. And now we have families who've lost everything, who've lost their homes, who've lost loved ones, who are being asked to rebuild their lives from nothing. They deserve help. They deserve justice. And it's pretty clear where that justice should come from. It's from these massive corporations that created the problem knowingly and recklessly.
So will your lawsuit call for damages to be paid?
So again, there are a number of lawsuits already filed that do call for damages to be paid. Talking about the potential for criminal prosecution, most states, including California, have criminal victim restitution statutes. And so it's certainly possible to imagine that under those statutes, these companies could be made to directly compensate all of the families that have lost so much in these disasters.
Mm-hmm. How many people are signed on or going to sign on to your lawsuit with you? Do you know?
So there are over 40 of these lawsuits that have already been filed, again, by cities, counties, states around the country. Our organization is working with a number of local prosecutors and jurisdictions around the country as well. In beginning to think through whether there could be, you know, a criminal case to add on.
Mm-hmm. So who would the plaintiffs be? The American people? Who would the plaintiffs be in your lawsuit? Attorney Regenberg. Mm-hmm.
So all of the suits that have already been filed, the plaintiffs are the actual jurisdictions filing them again, whether it's a city, a county, a state, or for any criminal prosecution that's brought by the local or state prosecutor. There are some pieces of legislation that have been introduced in states to create a private right of action around climate damages, so that anyone could file a suit. And we think that should be an important part of the justice conversation as well.
And so it can't all be blamed on fossil fuel, attorney. The companies will argue undoubtedly that they're merely supplying the demand for gasoline, et cetera. Your response to that?
We've had opportunities for decades to begin the transition to clean energy, and those opportunities have been systematically denied, blocked, and delayed by these companies in order to keep their gravy train, their profit spigot flowing. They did that fraudulently, right? They knew the reality of the catastrophic, in their own words, catastrophic effects their products were going to cause. Mm-hmm. And they knowingly and fraudulently deceived the public in order to block those solutions. We have laws for that. That is not acceptable behavior. That's not legal behavior. There's actually a concept in the criminal law and in civil law around an intervening conduct, which would which would make it so that a defendant's conduct cannot be held responsible for the result. And in the law, intervening conduct can only deny culpability if it were not reasonably foreseeable. I think it's going to be pretty hard for any of these companies to convince a judge or jury that it was not reasonably foreseeable that people would use their products exactly as they were intended, and indeed how they worked to make sure people didn't even understand the risks of those products. So I think that's going to be a hard legal argument for them to make.
I know that Jamie, you spoke of how there is a connection between the use of fossil fuel and the wildfires. Has that been documented scientifically? Has it been documented scientifically, or is that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's decades of research that clearly draw the connection between the burning of fossil fuels, the worsening of global warming and climate change, and then the extreme weather events that are happening today. You know, even more clearly, there's a growing field of science called attribution science that can trace back the responsibility of individual companies to extreme weather events like the LA fires. And they do that by breaking down the cumulative historic emissions of a company like ExxonMobil, and then can calculate their share of the damage that's been done. I think an important thing, Verna, that Aaron touched on is we're not saying that big oil companies should pay every cost of the climate crisis. But what we have to recognize is that right now, all of those costs, the cost of rebuilding LA, repairing people's homes, repairing roads and bridges that were washed out by Hurricane Helene earlier late last year, you know, right now, all of those costs are being borne by the public, while fossil fuel companies continue to rake in record profits selling a product which is worsening these disasters. And so what we're asking for via these lawsuits and increasingly pieces of legislation is to say, if you made a mess, you should help clean it up, just like Big Tobacco was required to pay in to a fund, just like a chemical company that dumps chemicals in a river is asked to help clean up that mess. These companies have been dumping carbon dioxide into our atmosphere for decades. We're now seeing the impacts of that, and it's time that they pay their fair share to deal with the damage.
And what about the role that Congress plays in this in terms of passing legislation to address the issue of the use of fossil fuel? And do you feel in any way encouraged by the Trump administration that's coming into office? Or not.
Well, let's actually maybe start at the state level, where a lot of good legislation is moving forward. You know, Aaron talked about the lawsuits that are holding big oil accountable. Running in parallel to that effort is a growing number of states that are pursuing what are called climate superfund bills. And these bills would help raise tens of billions of dollars for a state to respond to the climate crisis by asking fossil fuel companies to contribute into a fund based off of their historic emissions. So Vermont became the first state in the country to pass a bill like that back in May. You know, Vermont faced record flooding that put its entire state capital underwater. They responded by passing a bill that asks fossil fuel companies to contribute to a fund in Vermont. Just after Christmas, at the end of last year, New York became the next state to pass a bill. New York's bill would raise over $75 billion from fossil fuel companies over 25 years. And again, that's money that can go to help repairing communities, lowering costs for New Yorkers, making sure that people who lose their homes in an extreme weather event have some money to rebuild. And now there are bills continuing across the country, including in California, where I think after these LA fires, there's going to be a really strong push to say, we need to find a way to help pay for the disaster that's been done. You know, people like Anthony, who spoke earlier, are on the front lines addressing this crisis, putting their lives on the line. You know, our communities are draining their public funds that could be going to our schools and libraries to pay for disaster after disaster. It's time to make some of the richest corporations in the world, who are continuing to rake in profits from making this crisis worse, contribute to helping solve the problem. And so we're really looking for action in 2025 at the state level. You asked about Trump. No, I don't think Trump cares about this at all. I think he's eager to reward his big oil donors and his, you know, fossil fuel friends. And he honestly doesn't really care about individual people who have to rebuild. I don't think he's shown any interest in that. You know, that's something I think we need to highlight at the federal level. Trump promised to reduce costs. Well, you know, our costs are going up because of climate change, whether you're paying more in rent or you're lost your home from a fire, or you're going to the grocery store and food is more expensive because it's harder to grow crops. You know, climate change is driving up all of those costs across the board. And the Trump administration just doesn't have a plan to reduce those. I think it's going to be up to states and all of us to try and put forward solutions that really work.
Mm-hmm. So are there things that individuals can do personally to have an impact on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot that people can do. So at the local and state level, you know, we're building out a campaign with a whole coalition of groups all across the country to try and pass these climate superfund bills that would raise money to help us all respond to these disasters. So we have a website up, makepolluterspay.net, and all sorts of social media accounts on any platform that you want to go to. And so we'd love people to plug into the campaign. You can make a big difference by writing your state legislators, your mayor, your local elected officials and saying, hey, I don't want to have to pay the costs of the climate crisis on my own. I think it's time for big oil to pay their fair share. As Aaron said, there's lots of lawsuits being filed. Encourage your district attorney or your attorney general to bring a lawsuit against big oil. As Aaron said, this is a well-documented case, and these cases are spreading across the country. And so that's something that any place could be doing. Any town, any city, any state has experienced climate disasters now, and they could bring a lawsuit against big oil. And finally, you know, write your elected officials at the federal level. There is a proposal at the federal level to pass a bill. And, you know, that's something that can make a big difference if people get in touch with their members of Congress to take action. And the final thing I'd say, Verna, is programs like yours are incredibly important. I think that, you know, people understand that big tobacco played a role in lying to the public. The story of big oil is less familiar because they've spent billions of dollars to cover it up. And so it's up to all of us to help people understand that, you know, it's not just our fault because we didn't recycle one plastic bottle. You know, there are big corporations that are working hard to make this problem worse, and it's time we held them accountable.
Yeah, and this, I don't know quite how to form this. Does Elon Musk have an electric car? I don't keep up with what he does necessarily. Does he have an electric car, and might that be, you know, something to be optimistic about if he can promote that more?
You know, I think Elon, yes, indeed, has an electric car, an entire electric car company. But again, he's shown that I think he cares more about his own ego and power than he does about saving the planet. So, you know, look, one can hope that he convinces Trump maybe to move in the direction of clean energy. But I'm afraid that for those guys, again, they're looking out for themselves more than they are for regular working people. And it's going to be up to us to advocate for ourselves and really push for the solutions that we need.
And that's Jamie Henn. Aaron Regenberg, did you have any final thoughts in the last minute or two that we have left?
There's a quote that I think to me really says this question of, is it just people's demand or is it these companies that really are driving this? And Chuck Hagel, he's a former Republican senator from Nebraska. And he has this quote that I think it's worthwhile. He said, quote, "I was misled. Others were misled. When they had evidence in their own institutions that countered what they were saying publicly, I mean, they lied. It would have changed everything had fossil fuel companies told the truth. I think it would have changed the average citizen's appreciation of climate change and mine, of course. It would have put the United States and the world on a whole different track. And today we would have been so much further ahead than we are. It's cost this country and it cost the world." That's a Republican senator's quote. And I think it really, it speaks to the way in which the hole that we're in, we didn't just get here, we were put in here. And we need to be talking about justice for the people who put us in here.
Thank you so much. Okay, that was Attorney Aaron Regenberg of the Public Citizen Climate Program and Jamie Henn of Fossil Free Media. I want to thank you both for joining us, and earlier, Anthony Pedro as well, a incarcerated firefighter at one time, now the founder of his organization. And thank you all so much for being our guests this morning on What's at Stake. That's it for today's show. Thank you all for tuning in. And thank you to our program director, Katia Stitt, for operating as our engineer this morning. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
That is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what? Come on, baby. Slaughterhouses are killing hogs. Twisted children are killing frogs. Poor dumb rednecks rolling along.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program, Unionism Drives Community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. We will share the importance of knowing your rights in the workplace, the impact of unionism on working class advancement beyond the workplace, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And we hope that you will continue to listen to WPFW throughout today. This is Dr. King's birthday. We will have a special King programming on the